Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly romp through culinary history. And you know, we are now in the age of foodies, or food-obsessed, food-aware, whatever. Some of us don't like the word term foodies. But indeed, eating for us is now more than mere sustenance. It's an experience to savor, tastes to explore, and discoveries of new temples of food art. But how did we arrive at this point? And who came before us? My guest today, Dr. David Shields, has followed the lives and careers of the chefs, caterers, and restaurateurs who raised the profession of cooking and fine dining in America to an art form. His new book, The Culinarians, Lives and Careers from the First Age of American Fine Dining, published by University of Chicago Press, tells the stories of 175 of the masters who brought gastronomy to the cities in the United States. David is the Carolina Distinguished Professor at the University of South Carolina and the chairman of the Carolina Gold Rice Foundation. His scholarship explores three fields in general: early American literary culture, American performing arts photography, and food studies. His previous book, Southern Provisions, A Creation and Revival of a Cuisine, chronicles the emergence in the 1800s of a distinctive set of foodways along the southeastern coast of the United States. Shields has published extensively in the fields of early American cultural history and the history of photography. He's the sole author or editor of 12 now? and counting books. And he edited the scholarly journal Early American Literature for a decade. In 2016, he won the Southern Foodways Alliance's Keeper of the Flame Award. Welcome, David. It's a pleasure to have you.
Linda, it's great to be here.
And the book, I have to say, this, it's a phenomenal book. I didn't know what to expect. And I have in my hands the unexpected. It is truly unexpected. How did you come about writing this book? There are names and people in there that no one's really ever heard of.
It's strange that our memory of the finest cooking that's been done on this continent has vanished entirely. And we had restaurants beginning in 1793. We had great hotels which served cuisines from France, Germany, England, and later America.
America, right.
And the memory of anyone prior to James Beard and Julia Child seems to have vanished into smoke.
How true that is. How true that is. Well, you had written, I guess it was maybe in the introduction, that you were kind of surprised, as you just said, that there is no history of the professional cooking in America. Is this why you ventured forth on this book?
When I wrote my previous book on Southern Provisions, the my marching orders in that book were to explain the revival of Southern food, how a cuisine that once existed, particularly in the Low Country, and had gotten lost as the ingredients disappeared, was brought back. And during the process of that research for that revival, you had to look at who made the cuisine, the superlative practitioners of the professionals who made the food of Charleston, Savannah, world famous, much as the chefs in New Orleans made their cuisine world famous prior to the Civil War. And I was researching, and there was no history of fine dining in America. There was no history of restaurants. There were individual restaurant histories like Delmonico's.
Of course, right.
But who were the chefs? Who were the people doing the finest food? We actually knew more about home cooking in mm-hmm. early America and 19th century America than we did about the professional practice of cuisine.
That's true. And it's as a culinary historian, it's easier to research and to get your hands on information about home cooking than it is, as you mentioned, about, you know, the professional cooking.
Yeah, because cookbooks are the sort of default literature that one looks at. And mm-hmm. there are many early cookbooks that survive. But cookbooks are designed for home cooks, and they don't contain the refinements of professional practice, at least until the 1880s, when Charles Fraunhofer decides that he's not going to dumb down the recipes anymore and publishes this monster of a book.
Quite literally huge.
Right, called The Epicurean, which I'm sure many a purchaser must have read with horror when they realized how much labor, close attention, and skill was needed in order to create the dishes that appear in a place like Delmonico's.
And he was, for listeners who might not be aware, he was the chef at Delmonico's during a certain period.
You know? That's right.
Yeah. For the purpose of this book, you kind of divided up your time period. Now it covers 1790, when the first restaurant, fine dining. Certainly there were taverns and boarding houses, but the first fine dining restaurant in 1793.
That's right.
Up through 1919.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, Prohibition sort of destroys the financial basis for the restaurant world.
Kind of put a stake in the heart of the fine dining, right?
It did. And, you know, there's another story to be written about how hotels had to switch from alcohol to sugar in order to keep financially afloat in terms of their dining rooms, and how a certain subset of rather heroic individuals like Louis Diat, who is at the end of this book, kept the ideal alive until that post-World War II period when Gourmet gets founded and Lucius Beebe appears on the scene and, gastronomy once again becomes a public concern, and a second great age of fine dining emerges.
So this you call the first age. And within this first age, you divided it up into four eras. Can you describe for us what those four sections or those four eras are?
Yes, the beginning period talks about the creation of the institutions that really mattered. The restaurant, or it was originally called a restaurateur, and the hotel, and the oyster cellar, which was an urban institution where beer and oysters were served below grade. I then talk about the second sort of period where African-American caterers become the most significant event cooks in the major cities of the East Coast. I talk about the increasing emphasis on professionalization and the beginning of a kind of, I don't know, proprietary secrecy about one's finest dishes. Why is it that there is no cookbook published by a professional chef that actually talks about
his recipes?
Yeah, until about 1885. Yeah. It's because that's how you made your money. You don't give your secrets to your rivals. Then in the post-war era, I'm interested in the French hegemony, this period when French chefs spread across the United States and dominate the hotel and restaurant trade, and their professionalism is associated with a kind of theatricalism. They like to create food sculptures.
And when you mentioned sugar earlier, that it's all about building these incredible sculptures of food, right?
Yes, dining becomes a theater, and their dishes have remarkable, like, submarine worlds suspended in jelly or something like this. And the candied flower petal was something that was spread across everything. The final period deals with the Gilded Age and also the emergence and consolidation of the various ethnic traditions of fine dining, the German restaurants like Luchow's or Faust's in St. Louis, the Chinese restaurants like Wang Ferlo in San Francisco, or the various ones in New York and Philadelphia and Baltimore, and also the Italians, who are extraordinarily industrious. I talk also about the consolidation of Latino cuisine in Los Angeles, Jose San Roman, the pioneer there, and the beginning of Jewish catering in New York City, when I talk about David Cantor and his generation of hosts and caterers.
Well, I mean, it's interesting how I never thought about some of the people and the periods that fit into these different categories until you put it in perspective. And yet still, within those periods, yes, there are a few names that are, that pop out at me that we know, Ranhofer, Thomas Downing, people like that throughout history that, have been written about and known. But then there are so many of these names that totally have, escaped my reading, but I'm sure some people knew about. But then 175, and I'm sure you must have dealt with so many more. What was your final filter for who made the cut?
Oh, right. Well, over a number of years, I'd collected all sorts of information from various sources.
How many years are we talking about? Did you devote
maybe,
to this?
Maybe 10 years. but originally, I had included sausage makers, bakers, people that were engaged in the brewing and distilling industries. I wanted to do sort of anyone who made anything that was ingested, sort of. And then I realized that that way lie madness. And so I cut out the bakers and the distillers and brewers. And I looked at every city that mattered and sort of attempted to reconsolidate the entire dining scene. And I have twice as many biographies I wrote as appear in this book about New Orleans chefs.
Uh-huh. So we could do a whole book just on New Orleans.
Yes, that's right.
From your writing and your research.
And what happens is that you realize that many of these, certain of these people are replicating patterns that a pioneer had put out. You have Fritz Huppenbauer create the New Orleans oyster cellar. And then you have, you know, like eight different people who imitate him. Even within the year, there are four. And should you include those or the person who gave the idea?
Well, maybe this helps explain something. You said that you, that in doing your research, you ran into a lot of stories that were pretty much totally fabricated or that were lies, and you sort of tossed those out. Would these be people claiming to be the first to ever do something?
Oh, well, yes. And I wrote a book on silent motion picture photography at one time, and the publicity departments of the early movie production companies just generated stuff off the top of their head about certain of these people. And one of the things that I discovered is that any French chef who came to America claimed to have served in this restaurant or in Baden-Baden or worked with Carame or somebody else of great significance. And you couldn't take that at face value because...
They were building up their resume. They were padding their resume.
Padding their resume. And so, and then, you know, there are certain dishes that get created that at some juncture everyone tries to claim, like the potato chip, the Saratoga chip, which...
The story is still kind of out on that one, or the verdict's out. I'm not really sure about... I know you spent time up in that area, but... okay.
And, you know, there are at least nine people I encountered who, in their obituaries...
claim to have invented...
Well, their celebrators claim that he or she invented the potato chip.
Right.
And so... sifting lies is something that every biographer has to do, certain industries are prone to, I don't know, reigning myths or something like that. You know, think about how many restaurants these days claim to be farm-to-table restaurants that are local, and... it ain't necessarily so.
They make exception for lemons.
Yeah, that's right.
But and yet, as we mentioned, you know, cooking as a vocation and recipes had been around for centuries. But what was missing?
Yes, there comes a kind of professional consciousness in a class of cooks. It happens in the end of the 18th century. It's European before it's American. But there's certain things that you can count on generally in terms of a professional cook. One is a mastery of pastry cooking, which is a difficult proposition. It's a technical art, and you either can do it or you can't. You have to be familiar with more than one ethnic tradition. This is particularly the case in hotels when you're serving a populace that's made up in the United States of people from very different backgrounds. So if they want Hass and Pfeffer, you know, you better be able to produce Hass and Pfeffer. And this notion of being able, through your own repertoire, to serve a vast and multicultural clientele is one of the hallmarks of a professional consciousness. Most professional cooks expect to perform in a particular type of institution, whether it's a restaurant or a hotel or a hospital or being a cook for like the president of the United States or a significant figure. Later on, you have an interesting subset of people who are railroad cooks. One, the railroads make a particular claim to the quality of their cuisine.
Oh, railroad dining was the thing for a while, right?
Yes, that
was,
right.
It really was, you know, that's what you did.
So the professionals had those sorts of expectations, and... they also were assured of being able to handle numbers of people. They could cater events up to 1,000 people. And that kind of administrative skill is something which no domestic cook or plain cook was the phrase that was used in advertisements for people who were not professionals.
I mean, and that we know from ancient times. Yes. You know, that banquet cooking is, you know, the rules and orders of banquet cooking, not necessarily what you ate, but, you know, the administration of right. making all that, quite, or the delegation of it. And I was, something that was my aha moment as I was reading this, and, well, restaurants, and how did they, what set them apart? And you, when you mentioned the big banquets, of course, I think of the long tables. But you mentioned something very interesting that sort of set fine dining restaurants apart from other things, and it was the table.
Right.
I mean, we had the big, long refectory tables, as I mentioned, boarding houses early on. And suddenly, someone's idea to
James Stetson,
dine at small tables.
Who was the steward at the Astor House in New York City, decided to set up cafe-style dining. And that is, you had a table that would seat 4 or 6 or 2, rather than everyone being cheek by jowl with a stranger at the long refectory table.
Which, and look where we've come.
That's right. So... But it's interesting that refectory's table dining still survives in certain spaces like schools.
Mm-hmm.
Or if anyone's been to a church dinner recently, they always line up the tables in long tables and sit next to your co-congregants somewhere along the way.
Yeah, but it's interesting that, you know, that fine dining, you know, was related to that, to the small table, the cafe table.
That's right.
Well, or tables of 10. You could have tables of 10. That was still fine dining, small tables. You talk about these culinarians that you have chosen to pick them out as such, gastronomes, whatever you want, however you want to describe them, that there were 3 gifts.
All right.
What are the three, without giving everything away from them, what are the 3 gifts that you, I can help remind you a little bit, but.
Well, you know,
I'm
think
sure
that,
you know.
The things that are important about gastronomy is, one, that they make the process of ingestion, which is a natural thing, an object of reflection, so you become conscious of the food.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of consciousness, one's knowledge that something is good for you, your anticipations of certain pleasures, actually has a way of making dining artful. It becomes a part of your life that... it's not feeding, it's not just brute ingestion. It is a source of wonder, and that's important. There's also the dimension of these professional chefs offering a place in society where one can engage in sociable pleasure and celebration. You know, churches and synagogues provide a cultural space for worship, meditation, and religious spiritual reflection. The restaurant and the hotel, under the dominion of these exemplary cooks, provided a place where you can share joy and share the finest tasting food and drink with the people whom you love.
That's a tall order for any chef.
It is, but think about the way that, you know, the birthdays, the wedding banquets, the mm-hmm. the celebrations of the publication of a book. some of the most memorable occasions in your life. Mm-hmm. And if the food is superlative and the space is beautiful, it just makes those moments that much more wondrous.
Now, we're going to come back to these gifts, because there's something else I wanted to mention on that after we take a short break. So stay tuned.
I'm Michael Harlan Turkell, host of The Food Scene and Modernist Breadcrumbs on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here at Bob's Red Mill to find out from Bob himself why his products taste so good. So what's the secret, Bob?
To make the best whole grain flour, we look back in time. No modern technology can match the old world engineering of a stone mill.
Wow. Bob's Red Mill is using stone mills? How old are we talking here?
Well, the stone mills are practically as old as mankind, and no matter what civilization they uncover, they find two stones that people were rubbing together to make something they could eat, whole wheat flour. But the stones that we use are quarried near Paris, France, in La Ferté, and it's the same stone material from the same quarry that the Romans used to make stone mills all over the Roman Empire, of which you can testify by looking at Pompeii. It's a quartz material. It has a uniqueness about it. It's very hard. It has a certain porosity, and they put the stones together in a unit of 20 pieces and band it so that they use only the best and sharpest parts. It's an ingenious thing, but very old. I mean, thousands of years old. So it's pretty cool.
Those sound like some really special stones. How do they work?
Stones turn either the top or the bottom stone, turning at 100 to 125 revolutions per minute, produce a lovely 3-4 up to 500 pounds, depends on how soft the grain is. The bottom stone is the bedstone, and it's also called the nether stone in the Bible, but it also now turns for some configurations.
Would you say that using stone mills lead to healthier grains?
I know they do. I can watch it. I showed you. You know it as well as I do. The grain goes in the top, goes through the stones, and it comes out. We don't lose anything, and we don't add anything.
Thanks for sharing the story of how Bob's Red Mill is using ancient technology to keep their products on the cutting edge.
Michael, we think that we can make a difference by sticking by the traditional way of stone milling whole grain, and that's what we're doing.
You can learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Dr. David Shields, the author of the new book, The Culinarians, Lives and Careers from the First Age of American Fine Dining. And David, we were talking about the difference between just a cook and a gastronome or a culinarian, as you have.
Right, a chef, a caterer.
Or a restaurateur.
That's right.
Who directs it all. Right. There are, and I mentioned that there are so many names that were surprises to me, so many names that, yeah, I did recognize a few, but some I've never heard of. And I wanted to ask you, did you have a favorite or a few favorites? Or not favorites, people who just kind of jumped out at you and you kind of gravitated to their story.
Yes, there are people who I think are really significant. Jules Arthur Harder, in particular, strikes me as somebody that you have to know about. And he had an extraordinary French training. He was the chef at Delmonico's, at the Maison Dorée, at the Union Club. He even spent a year down in Savannah as a chef. And during this time, he becomes the great master in terms of knowledge of the food that's available in America. And he goes out to the West Coast to be the first chef at San Francisco's Palace Hotel. and he takes his knowledge of vegetables and demands that the growers in California produce these vegetables. He even secures seed for them. And the entire world of Californian vegetable production is, you know, in large part responsible to him. But he's given a gift to us as well, in that he intended to write a comprehensive 6-volume set of cookbooks covering all aspects of cuisine. He only published one, and it was called The Physiology of Taste, or Harder's Practical American Cooking. It is the Rosetta Stone of American vegetable cookery. The great genius of the 19th century in terms of American agriculture was the production of an enormous variety of new breeds of vegetable, tomato varieties, squash varieties. But the old cookbooks, when they cited ingredients, said, cut up a squash.
Use a tomato.
Right? Yeah, that's right, a tomato. Which tomato, which squash, which bean is best suited to which dish? Now, chefs who had haunted the vegetable markets of New York or Philadelphia or Boston knew they had the professional knowledge. And they didn't reveal it until Harder wrote this book. He cites all the vegetable varieties and how they hook up with the various ingredients. I think you can download this, you know, as an electronic book from Internet Archive.
Oh, terrific. That's great. So, I see why that story was near and dear to your heart, being involved in your work with recovering old, you know, restoring old heritage seeds. Yeah.
We know that the second volume, which was on fish, was finished in manuscript but has never appeared in print. So if any of you who are detectives or book hunters, the lost masterpiece of American cookery is this lost manuscript second volume of Harder's Physiology of Taste.
And that's a challenge. So the challenge goes out to you who are listening.
That's right.
You mentioned somebody else who was another story that was that kind of jumped out of your favorite, you thought that people should definitely know about. A woman?
There are many sort of remarkable women culinarians, and I treat 30-some of them. Mm-hmm. But the first one that I treat is Ann Poppleton, and she invents the lunch for America. She's a confectioner and pastry chef who has a shop near the Astor House in New York City. And she becomes the sort of center of the bon ton. Every fashionable young man or young woman went to Ann Poppleton's for...
long before Schraff's came around.
Yeah, that's right. she had an ice cream maker that was extraordinary. One of the things that... occurs during the period, the 1820s, that she is working in, is that sugar becomes cheap in America. And for the first time, you could preserve all of the harvest of your orchards by making preserves or jellies and jams. And so the 1820s becomes the golden age of jams and jellies. And it's Ann Poppleton who introduces the flavors of these things to people, and biscuits with jelly on them, breads with jelly and butter, jams, quince jam, become the cakes with layers of jams and jellies in them. Is a signature of Poppleton.
That is making me hungry just listening to that. And it'll be lunchtime shortly. There's one we were talking about different specialties. There's somebody I marked that, and I'm going to try to remember why I marked it. Oh, he was up in Saratoga, and right. He was in New York.
Saratoga is one of the things.
Oh, yeah, roasting. Oh. He refused to give in to ovens.
That's right.
He would only roast all his meats over the open fire. He said that is where you got the flavor of the meats. I love that.
One of the things we have to think about is the sort of transformation of the technology of cooking that takes place over this period. When Julien, the founder of the first restaurant in America, the Julien's Restaurateur in Boston, begins cooking, he cooks hearthside, that is, over using a fireplace with cast iron utensils, and he has a charcoal brick stove for his soups. The iron cook stove only becomes widespread in the 1830s mm-hmm. with the temperature control that could allow you to make sauces, where you have to cook things, emulsions, at low temperatures. And in the 1880s, the gas range becomes something that is extraordinary. And Schelcher is a person who has visions of barons of beef turning on spits and baronial fireplaces, and that's the way that meat should be roasted. And so in his hotel in Saratoga, all the people in the dining room would see the open fireplace with a spit jack with a side of beef or a haunch of venison sputtering away over the coals.
And that certainly has to whet one's appetite.
I'm sure the odor in that space must have had the gastric juices percolate.
Absolutely. Somebody else who, for better or worse, it caught my attention is James Parkinson.
Oh, yes. James Parkinson may have cooked the single greatest meal of the American 19th century. He was taught by his mother, who was an English confectioner. And Parkinson's ice cream parlor in Philadelphia was considered one of the most fashionable places in North America, the equal of Ann Poppleton's in many ways. And Parkinson learned the arts from her and actually assisted in publishing a book, which is about pastry cooking that she wrote. And he developed his own skill, and there was a bet made by 15 New York gentlemen with a club from Philadelphia that Delmonico's could produce a better meal than anyone could produce, any chef could produce in Philadelphia. Well, the Philadelphia club goes to Parkinson and says, "Will you take this challenge?" And Parkinson does take the challenge and prepares a meal that everyone immediately recognizes as the greatest meal that's probably ever been served in America. Hmm. He had game flown in from Georgia and salmon from Maine.
It was the ingredients.
Yeah, so the ingredients mattered, and that was important because after the Civil War, Parkinson gets into a kind of battle with Grand Duke Alexis of Russia, who toured the United States and claimed that all he was getting was second-rate French cuisine in hotels that he was staying in, and where was American cookery? And James Parkinson writes a kind of manifesto about where American cookery lay, and it's with a repertoire built out of native meats, game, and vegetables that are grown here.
Yeah, that's what struck me, I think, about him, was that kind of a question that I'm hearing when I talk to historians, you know, what is authentic American cooking? And he was the first to, you know, to beg that question. Well, so where is the authentic American cooking? And he was presenting it with the authentic American ingredients.
Right. Now, I think there is, you know, in the South, we have a very interesting situation where an African-American culinary tradition melds with Native American ingredients and Anglo-American, and there is a distinctive repertoire and set of ways of producing things in a body of dishes that mm-hmm. we now recognize as Southern. And to a certain extent, New England had that too, and yes. there were people who plied that. Talk about Ora Taft, who creates the greatest seafood restaurant to have existed in North America, one which offered as many as 60 different varieties of fishes at one time.
Hmm. Amazing. It's interesting because I think it was Parkinson, too, who, you know, built some elaborate or an original, unique pastry or something. And, of course, to vault it to the, you know, that people would recognize it, gave it a French name. you talk, and then, so you're one of your sections about the French hegemony and everything. If it was going to be elegant, if it was going to be worth, you know, spending money on, had to be French.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. Well, and the menus as well. Everything's written in, well, French or...
Right.
Or a sort of French.
Yes, and that, I mean, Franglish. The sort of Frenchified versions of various dishes, something which still exists in many American restaurants. But in the 1870s and 80s, when the French actually organized a set of professional organizations across the United States, they quite explicitly, you know, sort of take over the major institutions, and they set up employment agencies, making sure that the hotel that opens up in Boulder, Colorado has a French chef in
there. Right.
And escargot are being shipped by Henry Mo'Quinn directly to Boulder. So it's an interesting world. And I talk about some of the chefs like Jules Weber and Mo'Quinn who service that larger world of French cookery. I think, you know, another group that, you know, has to be recognized for their extraordinary contribution are the African-American caterers who mm-hmm. dominate the world of event cookery in the eastern cities. Mm-hmm. And whether it's Joshua B. Smith in Boston or Thomas Downing in New York.
I was surprised by the number of women, African-American women.
Yes, Emmeline yeah. Jones, Nellie Murray in uh-huh. New Orleans. And one of the things which has happened is that New Orleans has embraced Nellie Murray, and Zella Palmer, the professor at Dillard University, has brought about the Nellie Murray feasts that work to memorialize the African-American contribution to Creole Louisiana cuisine.
Right. Her story is definitely a very interesting one, as are all the stories in this book. This is, and I'm sure that it will become, since it's fresh off the presses, it's a very important book, David. I think you've really... you've told a story here that will, you know, that I think Americans should take note of and be proud of it, and it describes our cuisine.
Cookery is an art, and
yes.
nearly every other art has its hall of fame, its histories, and its pantheon of great performers, and why not cuisine?
And as we carry on with our modern chefs, we were talking about the gifts. What did these culinarians, what separated them from just, the regular cooks, you know,
right.
slinging hash, you said, were these gifts that they offered. And one, you mentioned that they were that the culinarians were intellectually curious.
Yes. They wished to create new tastes, new flavors. And
I guess that goes along with the being aesthetically experimental.
Yes.
Right.
When you see American commerce and American agriculture offer such a rich panoply of ingredients, And you think about your own technical training, how you have certain skills that enable you to combine and concentrate flavor. An incitement to creativity. And you had many people inventing important dishes. Oysters Rockefeller, which is the creation of Jules Alciatore of New Orleans, is one. And Vichyssoise, which is an adaptation of a French dish by Louis Diat.
Yeah. And there are some people, because the third gift that you talk about is this culinarian being gastronomically evangelical. Now, some are better at that than others, right. And some do more of that than others. Would you say that these three, I guess you call them gifts, but defining parts of a life in cooking, you feel that that is still true today?
Yes, I do. It's interesting that in terms of the evangelical dimension, you have so many different new forms of media,
yes,
that can present at least the visual dimension of the culinary experience. And it's a shame that we don't have smell-o-vision. Or that our small screen doesn't have a lick function or something like that.
Maybe it's coming.
Apple, are you listening?
Well, here at Heritage Radio, we do try to do our best at bringing those stories over the internet to people. As I say, this is a very important book. I will say that it's a very important book, and I have enjoyed it tremendously. I haven't read it cover to cover, just got it this week, but I can guarantee you I will, because once you start reading the story, it's hard to stop.
These people's lives are extraordinarily rich. The challenges that they faced were sometimes heroic. I have a French chef who wanders from mining town to mining town in the West, convinced that people who are newly wealthy with mineral wealth deserve French cuisine. So he winds up in the wilds of Arizona when
cooking,
he finally expires.
Well, so. You know. the book, again, I thank you, David, for sharing your stories. There are so many more, and your teaching about the history of American cooking. Again, the book is The Culinarians, Lives and Careers from the First Age of American Fine Dining by David Shields. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Lynn.
And thank you for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.